Good morning. It is Sunday, November 17th, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, three things to know about giving in this month dedicated to philanthropy.
And we'll be celebrating a month that's also dedicated to writing with an author and books montage.
But first, while giving doesn't always have to be about money, there was a lot of news about the Green this week. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has more in this week's Week in Review.
Money is regularly the root of many news items that come across the wire, and greenbacks are generally the point of pertinence for many stories. Case in point, the special election in Fayetteville this week was all about money. Just more than 9% of registered Fayetteville voters turned out to vote on the issue of using hotel, motel, and restaurant tax proceeds to partially fund construction of a regional park as well as the Walton Arts Center expansion project. Roughly 85% of voters approved measures to partially fund development of the regional park and the expansion project at the Walton Arts Center, a project that as a result of the election will receive up to $6.9 million from bonds funded by HMR tax receipts. Terry Trotter is the chief operating officer at Walton Arts Center. She says that now that the public funds are committed, private fundraising is one of the next steps for the expansion project.
You know, we have a lot of funds to raise for this, and we'll be, you know, working to continue to talk with people about the vision that we have for the future and get people excited about that. We are also working with our design team to continue developing the project. One of the things that will be, you know, interesting and challenging about this project is we don't want to shut the facility down. I mean, we don't want, you know, to not have a season at Walton Arts Center. So we're going to have to figure out how to do the construction while we continue to operate. So, you know, beginning to figure out how that will happen is another next step for us.
About a third of the funding for the expansion project will come from the public bond money. Another third is expected to come from supportive foundations, and the remaining third is expected to come from individual contributions. Of course, the results of the election mean that $3.5 million in bond money will also be directed to the City of Fayetteville's Regional Park Project. Another area city has also received monetary help for development projects. The City of Bentonville recently received a grant from the Endeavor Foundation to help expand pedestrian infrastructure in the city. Troy Galloway, the city's director of community development, says that the grant from the foundation, which was formally accepted by City Council this week, gave more than $70,000 to the sidewalk project.
We're going to couple that money with some community development block grant funding that the city gets on an annual basis to construct sidewalks on both sides of Southeast 6th Street from Main Street running eastward to the vicinity of F or G Street. And really that takes us from downtown Bentonville to the city's newest park, which is Austin Baggett Park, which is a little neighborhood park that's in the southeast part of downtown Bentonville.
Galloway says that without the grant from the Endeavor Foundation, which will cover about three-quarters of the sidewalk construction cost, the project would not be moving forward at this time. And sometimes government agencies need to bring in more money to keep providing public offerings. An increase in camping fees for some campgrounds at the Buffalo National River took effect Friday. Kevin Clark is the public information officer at the Buffalo National River.
We have to pay our bills too. So the campsites with amenities such as electricity and water represent high operating costs to the Park Service. And one of the stimulating things for the campground fees was that our electrical bills trebled, went up three times a few years back. And we've been operating at a considerable loss during that time period. We don't make any money on these. We're trying to break even with these costs, and so that's what it represents to us.
The fee increases represent the first such increases at the Buffalo National River in a decade. And sometimes cities give money out to non-governmental public organizations. The Fort Smith Board of Directors earlier this week approved recommended funding allocations to non-governmental agencies in the city. For the 2014 budget year, the city has $162,000 to split between agencies regarding social and community services, arts and humanities, and recreation. Christy Doyster, administrative coordinator for the city's finance department, says that although the program was reorganized about 3 years ago, the funding has given receiving organizations crucial assistance for more than 20 years.
When the new program was set up, that was one of the things that was extremely important, was that agencies ask just what was for necessities to keep their doors open. What could we help them with that would keep their doors open? Just basic bottom line expenses. And a lot of them do utilities. A lot of them are for the symphony, you know, helps pay for some of their musicians, and so does the chorale and music. The Western Arkansas Ballet helps pay for one of their ballet productions.
Doyster says that most applying organizations use the assistance to cover utility costs, as it is one of the easier expenses to track. But she also says that social and community services organizations, such as the River Valley Regional Food Bank or the Old Fort Homeless Coalition, make up a majority of the applications for city assistance. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Allison McElroy is the Foundation Director at Open Avenues in Rogers. Open Avenues is a job training organization for people with disabilities.
So our mission is to empower adults with disabilities by providing employment, education, life skills training, and meaningful work.
To better serve that mission, Open Avenues relies on financial support from many different sources, from the United Way to private businesses and individuals. We asked Allison McElroy, a fundraising professional, what she thought all of us should know about philanthropy. The first thing?
How good it feels.
She says giving, helping support a cause, quite simply, makes a person feel better.
It's a gift that gives back to you because of, I mean, they might say running, you know, produces endorphins, but so does giving. It really does.
Allison cites personal experience as proof. Open Avenues had a multi-year capital campaign to raise money for a new facility.
When we first started, you know, it was very daunting and stressful. And are we ever, you know, will we ever be able to do this? Is it just a dream? And the more we pulled together, and, I mean, the economy tanked. I mean, there was all kinds of things that happened during our campaign that would make someone maybe think, this is impossible. But we were like the little engine that could. And when we saw that it was actually going to happen, and when we got our land, and then we started seeing construction, and, I mean, you could just see board members and people that were serving on the building campaign cabinet, and people that had made pledges, you could just see the excitement and the, oh my goodness, this dream is really going to come true. And I had a part of that.
So giving money to a favored cause or causes can produce feelings of accomplishment, happiness, or even joy. Allison McElroy says a second thing we should know about philanthropy is knowledge that she says produces a sense of security. The Association of Fundraising Professionals, both nationally and locally, adheres to a set of ethical standards. Those standards, she says, should let donors feel confident that their contributions are being directed in the manner the donors expect.
So the ethics of fundraising, although you might hear, you know, still in the news about national organizations or small organizations that aren't following those ethical standards, you know, here in Northwest Arkansas and anyone else in the world that's associated with AFP, they have signed an ethical document and sort of an oath that they are going to practice ethical standards in fundraising and use the funds and or steward the funds like they're supposed to steward them. And there's not supposed to be any misappropriation or anything that's not on the table. There's a donor bill of rights where we talk about, you know, the rights as a donor. Your right is that you're supposed to know where that money is going that you've donated.
The AFP's existence in Northwest Arkansas has, she says, another positive effect. Fundraising professionals who discuss their profession build a better community of philanthropy region-wide. She says there is little rivalry among the members here.
We all feel more like we're in this together. What I've found that works for my agency might work really great for another agency, or it might not work for two different agencies might not be able to do the same thing. but we all seem to be in this together and truly knowing that the cause is the main focus. And so it's not really about which donors are going to give to who. You know, there are times we think, oh, no, the university just got all the money again, and we laugh, and it's always just a joke, but that's a joke that all fundraisers use, and educate people who are in education, they laugh too. I mean, it's, you know, education seems to always get all the donations is what we always used to say, but in our, even on the national level, when we all get together, it's about sharing and helping each other and encouraging each other and knowing that if you're doing your job right, it's really not about competition.
If that seems counterintuitive, that people who are paid to raise money don't seem competitive in seeking money, Allison says it's because there is a strong belief that giving creates giving, and that a sense of philanthropy can, in a way, be contagious.
The ones that are giving to their cause aren't necessarily going to drop that cause and go to another cause. They might add another cause because maybe their family dynamic has changed, and maybe they didn't have anyone with a disability before, but they've just had maybe a grandchild that's born with a disability, so now that's going to, you know, come into their realm of what they're going to give to. But it's once you realize it's not really competition, it's more of we're all in this together, and your job is to find the donor that fits, their passion fits your mission. And that's really what it's all about. And if you can find that donor that fits your mission, it's not something that you really worry about them leaving and going to someone else. If it happens and they do, I think most of us just there's usually circumstances and we understand why.
Finally, Allison says she wants people to know one more thing about philanthropy. You could call this the you can't take it with you rule of giving.
You're able to be philanthropic even after you've left this earth. And a lot of us are guilty of not thinking that way and thinking about having, you don't have to be, you know, a Tyson or a Walton or, you know, anybody that has, that we foresee as people with lots of wealth. You can just be Allison or Kyle and work for that nonprofit and maybe not have all the resources of a Walton or a Tyson, but you can still leave your legacy and your mark on somebody, even just a percentage of what your estate is going to be. And I think we hear this all the time, that so many people do not plan for when they're gone, so someone else makes all the decisions for them. The government comes in and says, well, here's what we're going to do with your estate. When if you would just take that little bit of time to make some, you know, it's an uncomfortable situation to think about what's going to happen, but if you take that time and plan that, not only can you benefit your family first, maybe your religious organization, but then there's a little bit that you could chisel out for your favorite charity, and you could continue to bestow that good feeling and that and all those good works and help so many people even after you've been gone.
Much of any discussion about philanthropy revolves around, of course, financial contributions to an organization or cause. And a member of any nonprofit will tell you, yes, of course, the money is important. But volunteered time can also be an important element in a not-for-profit success story.
There are so many people that they might not have given financially at first, but they started, you know, when I think of volunteers, there's so many things that flash through my mind, but one that I thought of for here in Northwest Arkansas, you think of the Walton Arts Center. When you get there and you give someone your ticket, that's someone that's a volunteer. They're not even paid to be there until 12 o'clock that night, you know, checking you in and checking you out and making sure you find your seat. They've got this whole army of volunteers and they just want to be involved, and they just want to do something.
Allison McElroy is the foundation director at Open Avenues in Rogers and a member of the Association of Fundraising Professionals Northwest Arkansas Chapter. November is National Philanthropy Month.
So the story of David and Goliath. Improbable underdog defeats the powerful favorite, right? Maybe not.
Goliath is a sitting duck. He doesn't have a chance. So why do we keep calling David an underdog?
I'm Guy Raz. Things you thought you knew that are wrong. On the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour begins today at noon on KUAF.
Have you received an Arkansas earthquake declination form in the mail from your insurance provider? The paperwork both informs customers about the availability of supplemental earthquake insurance, not included in standard homeowner policies, and provides an opt-out. But should you opt out? Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich provides an assessment.
2 years ago this month, a rare 5.6 magnitude earthquake shook central Oklahoma, as well as western and northwest Arkansas. Quakes were rare in Oklahoma, but since 2009, more than 200 magnitude 3.0 or greater have occurred. USGS scientists claim it's now the most seismically active region in the country. They traced the phenomenon to industrial oil and gas production, which has also caused a magnitude 4.7 quake in north central Arkansas. Then there's the New Madrid seismic zone in northeastern Arkansas, which new science shows is more susceptible than previously thought to tectonic stresses, including industry-induced quakes. So, is it a good time to maybe purchase earthquake insurance? Arkansas Insurance Commissioner Jay Bradford thinks so.
I think it's always good advice, since it's not covered under your traditional dwelling policy, that you should at least get a quotation and consider the risk and decide if you want to, you know, lay that risk aside by buying a policy.
The Arkansas legislature in 1999 passed the Earthquake Authority Act because it found earthquakes pose a serious risk in Arkansas based on scientific seismic hazard maps. An Arkansas Earthquake Authority was formed, made up of insurance agents charged with evaluating the marketplace for affordable and available earthquake coverage. A market assistance program, or MAP, was also established.
Well, it gives the Arkansas consumer a viable answer to the fact that their homeowner's policy may or may not cover earthquake insurance. Some companies do provide it, but if their company doesn't provide earthquake insurance, they can go through the alternative marketplace and secure coverage.
The market assistance program is also available to practicing insurance agents licensed in this state. 43 companies offer coverage in Arkansas. For now, no data exists on the number of Arkansans who carry earthquake insurance. State Insurance Commissioner Bradford says his agency is available to assist customers with any questions.
Our website refers to the earthquake coverage availability and the fact that it is not covered under many traditional policies. And our consumers division has an open door for people who call and ask questions about their coverage, and we can advise them of their options.
Most all policies will exclude earthquake and flood, so those are two items that you would need to purchase separately on a monoline basis outside of your homeowner's policy.
Michael Alexander is vice president of Virginia LLC, a full-service managing brokerage for licensed insurance agents in Arkansas, Alabama, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Florida, Missouri, and Mississippi. He's an expert on earthquake insurance in Arkansas.
You know, earthquake insurance is a gamble for all of us. You know, I think one thing that's important is how important is earthquake insurance in the event a catastrophe were to happen. I think we all need to be planned for that. You know, just think of your home as being deemed by the city or state not being able to be occupied or lived in. What do you do then?
And Alexander says the cost of coverage can be extremely affordable.
You know, it really depends on, obviously, the area that you're in. Closer to seismic zones, the rate's going to be a tad bit higher, and also the construction of your home. frame rates are normally cheaper than it's really frame and everything other than frame. So that would include brick, veneer, steel structures. Again, that rate can vary.
Argenia posts a calculator on its website. For example, a dwelling valued at $120,000, including coverage for 40% of personal property, a base earthquake premium will cost $120 annually. Such supplemental policies can range between $50 to as much as $300. If your insurance provider does not extend earthquake coverage, it can be purchased from a third-party provider, Alexander says.
What they'll do is they can go to the Arkansas Insurance Department's website, and they can get comparative rating on what earthquake insurance would run on their house in their area.
As of 2010, the Arkansas Earthquake Authority Act charged insurance companies to notify policyholders who do not maintain residential earthquake insurance or whose coverage is less than 100% of the insured value of their dwelling of their potential eligibility for residential earthquake coverage through the Market Assistance Program or the Arkansas Earthquake Authority. Applicants who choose not to purchase residential earthquake coverage from their insurer or the state must decline the coverage in writing.
Yeah, normally your agent should sit down with you at renewal or when your policy, your normal homeowner's policy is coming up. And what they're required to do by state law is if you decide to decline or not purchase earthquake insurance, you'll need to sign a form stating you wish to decline that coverage and that you realize that your normal homeowner's policy does not include earthquake insurance. So really it was a push by the governor and the insurance commissioner in the state of Arkansas just to make the citizens aware that earthquake is not included in the homeowners and that if you decline to have earthquake insurance either added to your policy or quoted separately, that you're fully aware of that and you sign a declination form.
But the earthquake declination form also protects the insurance industry from liability.
What that's for is absolutely. I think it's protecting. I think it's protecting the agent and the companies. At least making sure that they offer coverage to their insureds and to the citizens of Arkansas. Earthquake coverage. They can't force you to purchase that coverage, but they can certainly have a backup where you sign saying, I do not want this coverage. Because obviously, in the event of a quake or some activity happening, inevitably everybody's going to say, well, I was never offered this coverage.
Many assume FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Association, will swoop in to fix things after a major disaster. But first, a major federal disaster must be declared where you live by the President of the United States. If your home is wrecked, FEMA may provide you a grant to rebuild, depending upon your income, but such recovery funding by federal formula is limited and won't cover the total cost of rebuilding. Emergency low-interest loans are also available, administered by the Small Business Administration in FEMA, but they must be repaid. And a last resort is relying on the kindness of strangers, volunteer organizations, and charities that will help you to rebuild. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you'd like to learn more, you can contact your insurance provider or visit the Arkansas Insurance Department website and search the Consumer Services Division. You can also calculate earthquake coverage by visiting argenia.com/map. That's A-R-G-E-N-I-A, argenia.com/map.
As an Ozarks at Large listener, you may have noticed that at the end of every show, we highlight a smaller or lesser known town in the KUAF listening area. And perhaps we discuss its location. For this month's installment of What's in a Name, we look at the names of some of the smaller towns in Washington County, Arkansas. Jerry Hogan is a member of the Washington County Historical Society and author of the soon-to-be-released book, Angels in the Ozarks. Hogan says that it wasn't until the 1820s that people began settling northwest Arkansas. Most towns earned their names from the postmaster at the time of the post office's inception, either after that postmaster or a name of his choosing. Hogan didn't necessarily say this, but based on my observation of our conversation, towns' namesakes came from three places, either its location, like West Fork, it's literally the West Fork of the White River, a religious name like Zion, or after someone or some family like Durham. For today's installment of What's in a Name, we'll start with those that named the county seat of Washington County, Fayetteville. The town of Cane Hill, in western Washington County, was founded by a couple of men who were Cumberland Presbyterians.
Two of those men actually named Fayetteville after their hometown of Fayetteville, Tennessee. It was James Buchanan and John Woody actually named Fayetteville. And they were two of the commissioners that established Washington County. And then they asked them to name they had to rename Fayetteville from Washington Courthouse, and it was those two guys. The next flash forward of the Washington County Historical Society will have my mini article about the men who named Fayetteville, because most people don't know the actual names of the guys.
As Hogan will point out, many of the towns in Washington County have a connection to Fayetteville, beginning with what is today a small town almost on the Oklahoma-Arkansas border, Evansville.
It's one of the more interesting to me because it's named after Lewis Evans, who was our first sheriff of Washington County. He did a sheriff's census in 1829. He opened the first store out there in 1830, and he led that gold expedition out of Fayetteville in 1849, Captain Lewis. So Evansville, boy, he's got that one tied down.
Another location named after a person is Tontytown, though it is pretty well known that this small city was named after the explorer Henry de Tonty. But it was named that by Father Pietro Bandini, who established the town for Italian immigrants.
One story I want to tell about Father Bandini, if I could, is that here in Fayetteville, Albert M. Burns built in the late 1880s and early 1900s. He built everything. He built all of our original schools. And I think because they were Catholic was the connection between them. Mr. Burns was an Irishman. And when Father Bandini was getting ill towards the end of his life, I found an article that talked about Mr. Burns took him down to Little Rock to the hospital, and they kept him there kind of hospice at the end of his life. And they said the services were held in Mr. Burns' house for Father Bandini. So I kind of like this, kind of a nice little touch.
Durham in eastern Washington County was settled in the 1830s, but it's debatable where the name Durham comes from. There were Durhams in the area, which is the most likely case, but it is also rumored that it was named after Durham, Scotland, or Durham, North Carolina. Durham's claim to fame is that it is the home of Major League Baseball player Sherm Lawler, who got his start as a bat boy with the Fayetteville Angels in the early 1940s. As we move west to Elkins, we find the home of another major leaguer, Jim King, who is still alive and living in Elkins.
Apparently Elkins is a conglomerate, a combination of communities Hood and Harris, and Hood seems to have had a date of about 1885 and Harris about 1888. According to the books and the history, it says Elkins was incorporated in 1964, which I assume means, incorporated in 1964. But it was Elkins way before that, because it was Elkins when I was a kid. I remember very clearly.
Hogan isn't sure why it's called Elkins, perhaps due to elk that roam the area, or maybe after a family. Ray's Mill is yet another town with a connection to Fayetteville, though it was originally named Valley Steam Mill.
But the guy that put up Ray's Mill is William H. Ray, and he's the son of Pleasant Vincent Ray, the first mayor of Fayetteville. If I'm not getting this wrong, and I might be, but I think William Ray is the guy who won a bunch of money in a gambling and used it to buy the mill. I think it's the right one. And that's a great story if it was.
There's also the town of Johnson, just north of Fayetteville, named after the Johnson Mill. Winslow in southern Washington County, formerly Summit Home, changed with the advent of the railroad, named after Edward F. Winslow, president of the Frisco Railroad. Winslow was once a busy and thriving milling, logging, and tourist town, thanks to the railroad. Then there are the towns with names that are religious in nature. Hogan's birthplace, Zion, is a biblical synonym for Jerusalem or a portion of that city. Zion Road in Fayetteville, Hogan says, is the road to Zion. And not far from my home is Goshen, originally College Grove.
And the late A.D. Poole, who used to be was a president of the Washington County Historical Society, was trying to find out why it was College Grove. And he had it pinned down. I think the guy's name was Wainwright, or Reverend Wainwright. And A.D. had him pinned down to the Methodist church here in town. And he thinks he named it after some town he came from.
It was renamed Goshen by the Reverend Moses Dutton, who later became the postmaster of that city and is a very distant relative of Hogan by marriage. The land of Goshen is named in the Bible as the place in Egypt given to the Hebrews by the Pharaoh of Joseph. Mount Comfort is a town out to the northwest corner of Washington County, and yet another name religious in nature. It refers to the Sermon on the Mount, the longest piece from Jesus in the New Testament, a series of moral teachings and sayings. Some obvious names in Washington County: Lincoln, after President Abraham Lincoln, though it wasn't settled until 20 years after his assassination. Prairie Grove, a grove on a prairie. Elm Springs. Farmington, with ton meaning belonging to, so belonging to farming. And Greenland. This research, Hogan gives credit to some of the students there.
The names it had, originally it was Frog Pond, which makes it one of my favorite ones. And it was renamed Rugby for a while by, I think that was railroad people in 82. And it was called Staunton in 86 and then Greenland in 1909, incorporated in 1910.
Jerry Hogan is a member of the Washington County Historical Society and author of the book Angels in the Ozarks. He will be at the Fayetteville Public Library for a book launch Saturday, November 23rd from 11 a.m. to noon. This is Ozarks at Large.
There are several visual art exhibitions on display this month throughout our listening area, including one titled Beirut Speaks. It's on display now at a Fayetteville restaurant. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
The photography exhibit is on display at Coco's Lebanese Cafe in Fayetteville, and it was created by Jamie Holland. The University of Arkansas student who grew up in Helena and earned a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in graphic design from Arkansas State University is now working on a master's degree in cultural anthropology with a focus on Middle Eastern studies. Earlier this summer, she was able to spend about 6 weeks in Beirut, Lebanon, to study a unique form of street art.
There is one photo of this huge wall in Carantina in Beirut, and it says Beirut Teki, which means Beirut speaks. But before that, it was in 2007 when, after like a series of bad things started to happen and the invasion, a street artist named Fish with a Lebanese filmmaker called Siska wrote on this huge wall. It said Beirut in Tekin, which means if Beirut could speak. And then, like, 7 years later, you know, this graffiti movement is just really getting bigger and bigger. And so Fish went back and wrote Beirut Speaks over that wall. So I thought that was really inspiring and really cool.
The specific kind of street art Holland is studying is known as calligraffiti. It combines graffiti with Arabic letters and Arabic calligraphy. During her trip, she was able to interview different artists, and through her research, Holland says she discovered that in Lebanon, they don't understand the concept of tagging and graffiti art as we know it in the United States. She says these street artists began writing in Arabic and using calligraphy because it presented more of a challenge to them, and also because it can be read by all Lebanese citizens, who Holland says grow up speaking Arabic, French, and English. She says in talking to people, she found this theme of an identity crisis, perhaps because the Mediterranean country has been influenced by a variety of cultures. However, the street artists feel Arabic is their heritage, and they really want to make a claim to that.
And also, they know very well that the politics in Lebanon aren't that great. It's very divided with sectarian discord and struggles. And so they decided, because their messages can be read, they wanted to try to empower their citizens by writing messages that say things about their country, you know, and sometimes, more often than not, the messages are very, they have a lot of satire and humor in them. It's not really meant to, you know, save Lebanon. They're not trying to make Lebanon secular, because they know that that's a ginormous task that they cannot do. But they know that they can empower their citizens by, you know, asking a question with their messages, not necessarily pointing to an alternative or finding an answer for the sectarian discord, but they can tell their citizens through their work that, you know, they do have a choice in the political, social atmosphere.
Holland says they are embellishing their country by taking calligraphy, which is so artistic, traditional, and embedded in their society, and mixing it with graffiti. Holland also says she found the artists are influencing young audiences in a positive way.
One of the more prominent graffiti crews, they're called Ashik Mon in Lebanon. They studied graphic design in college, and then they worked for advertising companies, and then they decided to use their work. And so now they do an urban wear shop where they have T-shirts and hats and things like that. They also do a lot of work for art nonprofits and things like that. And they call this old school meets new school. So they're taking the old school calligraphy and applying it to the new school graffiti. And they really are, they feel like they're doing a lot of good with it. And I really think that they are, because a younger generation sees this and they look at the Arabic words on the graffiti and they can read it. And, you know, they feel that Arabic is becoming cool again in a society where it wasn't as cool. And so now a younger generation wants to kind of mimic the Arabic graffiti because, you know, it's what they speak. It's what they grow up learning to speak. And rather than, like, mimic other forms of graffiti that aren't really associated, like, that don't really apply to Lebanon.
Holland says during the Lebanese Civil War, which lasted from 1975 to 1990, political parties would stencil their logos all around the city, which would often divide the city along sectarian lines. Following the Israeli invasion in 2006, she says the government banned graffiti that has any kind of political message. It's about this time that these types of street artists began to emerge. She says similar to street artists in the U.S., street artists in Beirut have a limited amount of time before the police arrive. However, Holland says when compared to artists in, say, New York City, street artists in Beirut have a much longer time to work on their pieces.
It's funny. It's illegal, but it's tolerated. And so some of my friends actually did get caught by the cops, but more often than not, they could talk their way out of it. And then sometimes the cops would look at the work and be like, oh, that's cool. Can you paint my portrait? And so it's funny how it worked out for them. And so and also the people really like it, too. Some businesses with nice walls will ask some of the artists, you know, can you paint something on this? And so they really are embellishing the city for the good with this. And so I think that the government and the police are really starting to like this kind of street art. And so that they're a little bit more lenient with it rather than tagging that we're commonly used to being associated with being a gangster and stuff like that.
In addition to the street art, the exhibition also features photos of the city and of the Roman ruins in Baalbek, Lebanon. Holland plans to return to Lebanon in May. She says there is a lot of research that's fascinating, but it doesn't always get talked about. So this exhibit is a good way to share the story of these Lebanese street artists whom she learned about through her research.
I just hope that people will be inspired and just really try to understand, you know, this, try to, like, break things down, you know, rather than just seeing a pretty picture, but understanding the story behind the picture as well, and maybe move forward with that.
Beirut Speaks is on display now at Coco's Lebanese Cafe in Fayetteville. The exhibit is free and open to the public. Professionally mounted prints of the photographs are available for sale. More information is available by emailing jamie.alyss@gmail.com.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda filed that story for a daily edition of Ozarks at Large earlier this week.
It is Sunday, November 17th, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellams.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Have you noticed he keeps showing up on Sunday? What's up with that?
He does.
And we were going to talk about girly stuff.
We were. Well, Kyle. Okay.
We'll talk about girly stuff anyway. Right. He'll just have to hang with it.
Go back to bed.
It's that time of year.
Well, my birthday's coming up.
Well, I know exactly where to get your gift.
Okay.
It is time for the Block Street Art Sale.
Okay.
And the Little Craft Show and the Community Creative Center Holiday Bazaar.
Right.
And I'm very happy.
And these remind me of my birthday, because usually the weekend before my birthday, my mom and I go around to all of these local craft shows.
Very convenient.
And mom
mm-hmm.
buys presents.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, they are December 7th this year. When's your birthday?
December 3rd.
Oh.
So it's after my birthday.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're all on the 7th?
They're all on December 7th.
Okay.
So not one stop shopping, but one day shopping.
Exactly. Well, the Block Street Art Sale, which is now the Holiday Art Sale, because it left Block Avenue and went to Mount Sequoia.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's leaving Mount Sequoia mm-hmm. and going to the Lifestyles Blair Center.
Okay.
But they're going to have lots of space. It's a really cool building. This is the folks, Don House and Marie DeMaroukas and Deborah Dubois and Faye Alter. They've been doing this for 13 years.
Man.
So I think it's the granddaddy of this batch of shows. And they said they're not really adding artists, but they have more room so people can bring more things and different things. And they promise it will still be the party it always is.
There was a lot last year.
Oh, yeah. And this one is from 7 to 9 on the 6th, 9 to 5 on the 7th, and noon to 4 on the 8th.
3 days.
So you really can't stretch that one. And the Blair Center, you know, is on South Thompson in Springdale, just north of the Northwest Arkansas Mall.
Oh,
cool-looking building with a map room and a giant fish tank. So you can plant the kids in front of the fish tank.
And then walk away.
Exactly. The Little Craft Show, this is 3 years.
Right.
And it is growing up to, it went from 24 vendors the first year to 55 the second year to 70 this year. They're taking the whole Fayetteville Town Center.
Growing exponentially.
And they said they're done growing as far as vendors. But they're always happy to see more shoppers. And they have the Pinterest... Help me here.
Etsy?
Kind of like Etsy feel. It kind of feels like Etsy. I mean, it was pretty crowded last year.
Oh, yeah. In the first year? Mm-hmm. Did you go the first year?
I didn't. Last year was the first year I went.
The first year, it was stuffed into a little building on North College, and you couldn't turn around. There were so many people there.
Well, I was shopping in Little Rock this past weekend, and a friend of mine has kind of an Etsy-esque store, and she said, I was looking at a pair of earrings, and she said, yeah, this artist got turned down for being to be in the Little Craft Show.
Wow.
Because they have there's so many artists that want to be a part of it.
It is mm-hmm. really trendy right now, and it'll be a lot of fun. And that's 11 to 6 on the 7th at the Fayetteville Town Center. And then the Community Creative Center, which I think is my favorite.
I like
but
that
I didn't
one
say that out loud.
At Nadine Baum Studios.
Everything's new there. They've got a new executive director. They've got a new program manager. But they've got the same artists, you know, Marcella Thompson and Mike Waldy and people like that. And then some new people like Sean Fitzgibbon.
Mm-hmm.
And they will have all sorts of things. They say they want to pack the building with art. So that'll be fun. And that's from 10 to 4 on the 7th. So you can see your plan here. Mm-hmm. And there are some other things coming up. The Alternative Gift Market,
right,
which is an opportunity to support area nonprofits, is from 9:30 to 2:30 today at First United Presbyterian Church in Fayetteville, and then 8 to 4 on December 4th at St. Paul's.
Okay.
There's a fall art show November 30th and December 1st at Inn of the Ozarks Convention Center in Eureka Springs, and the $5 admission goes to Eureka Springs School of the Arts. And there are also things this afternoon.
Such as
the Snow Train Village, which is at the Carnegie Library Annex in Eureka Springs.
Oh.
You can't buy the trains. You can just go see them.
Okay.
10 to 5 today, and admission is $2 to $5 that benefits the Historical Museum. And the University Theater has She Stoops to Conquer on stage today.
Yes.
One of those great 18th century manners plays. That's at 2 o'clock, and I promise you'll have a good time at any of these things.
All right.
You have a money-back guarantee.
Very good. Thank you, Becca.
Becca Martin-Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
On the next Celtic Connections, we welcome Irish singer-songwriter Danny Ellis, who gives us a reading from his new book about growing up in an Irish orphanage and songs inspired by that experience as well as others.
Wide awake, my eyes are open.
This is Brian Kelso Crowe inviting you to join me for a visit with Danny Ellis on the next Celtic Connections.
Celtic Connections begins this afternoon at 3 on KUAF.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Earlier, we were talking on this program about November being National Philanthropy Month.
It is.
But it's also
National Novel Writing Month.
So this is the month where people are encouraged to try to write a novel?
50,000 words, I believe. A story of 50,000 words. I'm not sure if that's quite a novel, but it's a lot of words. So.
Well, it's I would call it a novel. Have you ever wanted to write a novel? Have you ever seen yourself as someone who could, who would like to write a novel?
No, I think more short stories would be my.
So you have thought about writing fiction?
I like to write. I do. But I don't think I would have the dedication or the patience to sit down and try to write something that long.
I've tried to write fiction, and I can say unabashedly, I'm horrible at it, and I know that. So I am not going to participate in Write a Novel Month.
Okay.
But I hope everybody else who wants to does.
Well, will you participate in our Sunday morning montage?
I will.
Okay.
It's all you put it together, and it's all about books and writing.
Books and authors, yes. Here are 10 clips.
Paperback writer.
To begin, how to start. I'm hungry. I should get coffee. Coffee would help me think. But I should write something first, then reward myself with coffee. Coffee and a muffin. Okay, so I need to establish the themes. Maybe banana nut. That's a good muffin.
Chapter one. Get a lot written today?
Yes.
Hey, the weather forecast said it's gonna snow tonight.
Floor 5, subway muggers, aggressive panhandlers, and book critics. Floor 6, right-wing extremists, serial killers, lawyers who appear on television. Floor 7, the media. Sorry, that floor is all filled up. Floor 8. Escaped war criminals, TV evangelists, and the NRA. Lowest level, everybody off.
Really sick sense of humor.
Wait a minute. My first book, Treasures of Lust, I hid the treasure inside the statue.
You're talking about?
I love you, darling. Baby, you know I do. But I've got to see this book of love, find out why it's true.
Wonder, who wrote the book of love?
If you'd like to know those 10 clips that are in our Sunday montage, you can go to OzarksAtLarge.com.
Friday, Boom Kinetic released its newest album, Future Colonial. Earlier this week, the local band stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio to perform a few songs from the new album, including this one.
So we are Boom Kinetic, and this is a song off our new album, Future Colonial, called City Ocean. It's about two things that don't go together very well.
City.
That was Michael Gamboa, Zach Gump, Wiley Seeger, Greg Guillot, and Aaron Schauer, who together make up the band Boom Kinetic. The group stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio earlier this week. Boom Kinetic's newest album, Future Colonial, is now available on iTunes. The band is celebrating the release of the album with a show November 22nd at the Rev Room in Little Rock. More information at boomkinetic.com.
It's time for the KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. This drawing is your chance to win a gift from one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Serta Pro Painters, the Alma Performing Arts Center, 11 at Crystal Bridges. Winners will be announced Friday, December 13th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. To register or for more information, visit our website, KUAF.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Middleton.
Where's Middleton?
Carroll County.
Is it spelled M-E-T-L-A-L?
I believe. Oh, okay. See, this is how you get me in trouble. You ask me these questions. I don't have the map in front of me, but Middleton.
Okay.
We salute you, however you are spelled.
Okay. Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Antoinette has the show tomorrow at noon.
She does. Until then, thanks for listening and have a good Sunday.